Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's January 4th, 2015. It's a whole new year. It's a whole old Carrington. Welcome to episode 91 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know.
The RCR, I'm going to read this verbatim from our show notes so you can see how professional we are. The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, .. Supposedly, I'm to vamp there, but I'm not going to. Instead, I'm just going to introduce you to the roundtablers, roundtableites, whatever. So, here they go, four names you'll know well. First off, he comes from a land down under where women glow and everything else tries to kill you. It's Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael.
G'day, mate.
Oh, that's nicely cliche of you. I appreciate it.
Oh, I thought I was using my American accent.
Well done. Next up, we have the mad genius behind Juice GS, which is why his personal motto is "The juice is worth the squeeze." It's Ken Gagne. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Carrington. How are you?
Excellent. Is that actually your motto?
Sure, why not?
Will you get it tattooed on you now that I've said it?
Oh, I guess I have to.
So I look forward to the YouTube video about that. We are also joined by a fellow in his secret lair deep inside the bowels, yes, bowels of Boston University, which is fully accredited as far as you know. It's Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Hello, all. And hello, Carrington.
No, you can refer to me as all, or sometimes the one, or Mother Brain. All those work well for me. And finally, we have token Atari guy, Jack Nutting. Hello, Jack.
Wow. That's what I've always dreamed of being, token Atari guy. Thank you.
I think this is the first time you and I have been on the show at the same time.
It is. It is. I've been on most of the time since November or so, but we haven't overlapped. So.
But I have most of the time not been.
There you go.
So yes, so it is yet another roundtable. It is yet another year. Very exciting. And because I'm host, I get to pick the host topic, and I'm going as cliche as possible. Retro resolutions. New year, time for some resolutions. I'm subtitling this, Looking Forward to Looking Backward. So as I've written in our show notes, every year brings a fresh opportunity to fail at something you love. And I want to go around the table and see if any of you, or maybe all of you, have some retro computing goals, some plans for the coming year, or the things you would like to do that have something to do with our hobby, some things that you would like to, at this time next year, look back and maybe have accomplished or at least given it a good go. So let's go around the table, maybe in the order that I introduced you, and we can see who's got what they are looking forward to looking back to. Michael, what have you got?
Well, I'd like to make some room in my 8-bit bunker so I can actually do something. There's just too much stuff in storage down there at the moment. But as far as projects go, I would like to get my VZ200 and VZ300 computers up and running and getting some Z80 programming happening.
I appreciate your use of Z.
Sorry, I don't understand. Is there any other way to say it? That is how it is spaced throughout the empire.
That is indeed how it is spaced.
Or are you saying those colonialists just to the south of you don't get it?
They don't. They really don't. We sit on top of their country and they just don't get it.
Next time they join, I'll just have to take them to task over it.
Well, speaking of which, let's talk to one of them now, shall we? Ken, what have you got coming up in your very busy life? Supposedly, presumably, between the magazine and the YouTube and all the many things I see you talking about on Twitter, you must have quite a bit coming forward that you're looking forward to.
Well, I would be very excited to just maintain the level of commitment I have now, especially with Juice GS entering its 20th year. Oh my goodness, I never expected that this magazine would last this long. That makes 10 years that I've been editor. So that would be cool to just see it through at least this far. That would make 80 issues. And then, of course, the next milestone is 100 issues, which means we have to do this for another 5 years. Let's see about that. But in the meantime, if I actually were to add something to my plate, what I would really like to do, and I have poked around on the Facebook page of Apple II Enthusiasts, the group inquiring about this, I would really like to add to my YouTube channel, which does a lot of Let's Play videos of console and computer games, Let's Plays being where I offer a recording of the game as I'm playing it with my subjective experience and audio commentary. I would like to do that for some Apple II games. I did it a little bit with Zephyr from Brutal Deluxe or Froggy Software, and also Retro Fever from Brian Peachy. And I would love to go back and play some older games that have been out for decades, like Agent USA or Conan or Castle Wolfenstein or Choplifter or Lode Runner. I haven't done that yet. I haven't found exactly the right game to do that with. I don't want to do an extended RPG like Ultima or Wizardry. And I'm not quite sure what other game I can do that you can actually complete in, say, an hour, as opposed to a game that you just play and it's sort of like Tetris, where there really is no end. You just play it infinitely, like G Shizen. Yeah, I don't want to do a Let's Play of that, for example.
Well, so, a lot of the arcade games have multiple levels. You could play at least to get to the end of them, like Conan's like that.
Right, which is why I suggested that one. I loved growing up with that game, but also I am especially drawn to games that I did grow up with, like Conan, and I don't know what other games might have that nostalgia factor. So if anybody has any recommendations, feel free to email me at kgagney@gamebits.net.
I'm going to recommend the one that I'm choosing later in the show for my eBay auction pick.
Well, we will wait with bated breath
until
that moment.
Little tease there.
I guess I need to stick around this episode then.
Yes, you do, click.
Aw.
So, Paul, what about you? What are you looking forward to looking back upon?
Oh, I have a million projects going on, and I think maybe...
You're going to list them all for us now.
I am not, but I think my hope for the year is to focus a little bit enough to actually finish individual ones. So the thing I've been working on recently has been kind of a disk image process that would allow protected disks to be used in an emulator. And so my sort of narrow goal is to have that done by this time next year, or even by Kansas Fest. But just basically organizing. I hope to be more organized this time next year and actually have finished a couple of the things rather than started all of them.
Speaking of that, the disc project, was it Sneakers, I think, you had running recently on Twitter? I saw in the Twitbook.
Yeah, that's part of the project. Basically, the disc gets sampled by an EDD card, and then what I'm trying to do is figure out a way to get those bits back into something that an emulator can use. So I succeeded in getting Sneakers to work. So I posted a screenshot of basically the opening screen that isn't in the crack. You know, that's a little bit of a reason to believe that it's actually the protected disc.
Nice. Good game. And good movie. Good
indeed.
All around.
Yes.
Fun word to say. Everything's good about Sneakers. What about you, Jack? Newbie to the show.
Yeah. Well,
what have you got coming up?
What I'm thinking about doing is, I think this year's going to be the year that I finally really get my hands properly dirty in 6502 assembly. Something that I've been sort of poking around at for, 30 odd years. And in the past year, I actually started delving into it some more, and I've done a little bit of 2600 coding for the thing. I've got some basic skills, but I finally want to really sort of get into the nitty gritty of actually building some real software with 6502 assembly. And I've gathered enough of various bits of hardware and software that I have sort of the foundation there that I can finally apply my years of actual computer programming in high-level languages into a low-level language and get some work done. That's what
I'm
shooting for.
That's exciting. I like it. I like that goal very much. My goal would be similar. I've been thinking about this a lot the last couple of months, and it bothers me that I have coded for so many years, and yet I think it was Ryan Sunaga used to always say, if you go to Kansas Fest and you're a programmer and you don't have something to release, then you suck. And I have sucked every time I've gone to Kansas Fest. But this year, I vow that I will not. My main resolution when it comes to retro things is I will release some piece of Apple II software at Kansas Fest. Figure I've got 6 months. There's no way I can't come up with something, a game, a utility, something that I code and release. So that is my goal, is sometime in the next 4 or 5 months have finished so that I can then beta test and then release at Kansas Fest some form of software for the Apple II. So that's my personal goal. We will see if in the end of July we are speaking of my glorious success or my abject failure, but it's best to state your goals clearly, I think, so that you can evaluate them. That's my goal. Release something at Kansas Fest. So I guess the next thing is we will turn the microphones around and face them out into the world where we can hear what our listeners shout back at us. Looks like we've got some listener feedback. I haven't read any of the emails, so I guess I'll throw it over to somebody else. Paul, do you know about this stuff that's come in?
Well, yes, some of it anyway. So listener Tony pointed out a 6502 emulator that was written in Lisp, and so I haven't tried any of this, but and I don't think it's new, but it's weird. So if you want to emulate the 6502 and you want to do it in a really unusual fashion, here is a Lisp implementation of it, and there's a link in the show notes. What I was hoping actually is that we could get this to run on a Lisp running on Apple II, but I haven't gone that far yet.
Well, there's a reason to fire up my Lisp suite.
I suppose I could run on a PET. Tony also pointed out that a port of Quake to an oscilloscope, which apparently has been making the rounds. Many of us have seen this. It's not a great version of Quake, but it's a pretty cool thing. Other people have seen the video.
Oh, indeed, yeah. Yes, I was quite impressed by it. It's one of those things where I agree it's maybe not the best way to play Quake, but it's a heck of an accomplishment. You look at it and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe that actually works. And it clearly is Quake on an oscilloscope.
Especially given that video games were essentially born on that medium with Tennis for Two, to see it's evolved all the way into playing Quake is rather impressive.
That's one of those things where if you had a time machine of some sort, you go back and you look at the early people playing their games and you break out, here's what I've done, guys. I'm like, oh my gosh. So, though I wonder if you didn't already know the game, how clear the images would be. I can clearly see, hey, you're going down a hallway, but I wonder if that's just because I know what I'm looking at. And regardless, quite an impressive port.
So a couple other things that came up. Listener Brendan pointed out a brief article about Valdox and Rising Star that was written by somebody who worked at Rising Star. So that's interesting. It would have been great to have Earl here, actually, because it's Epson-related, but Rising Star wrote Valdox, and Valdox was one of the main selling points for the Epson QX10. So it was kind of neat to just read a relatively short account of somebody who was in the company and, sort of talked a little bit about the turmoil and so forth, but it's a short article. Still neat to hear from someone who is there.
That is very cool.
Another thing that got sent to us by email was Bob pointed out that there is an HP 25C and also HP 21 and HP 33C hardware emulation kit available, which you can buy assembled or as a kit. Bob had said that he just got his and it seemed pretty cool. There's a video of what it being demoed. I am not by the way, this is a calculator. I'm not all that familiar with the sort of like vintage calculators, but so I don't really know what the significance of the HP 25C is. But if you want to have a kit building project, this seems like a kind of a neat one.
Nice. It's only I think $27 or something for the kit. So if you're into it, that's a pretty good price, I think. I remember that I had an HP 25. Not the C, but I had an HP 25 back 100 billion years ago, I think. Early 80s is when I had it. I think it was out. It was like an old calculator at the time, but I had it 81, 82, something like that. So I liked it. I liked the sticky yippy buttons on it. Made me happy. So let's talk retro news. Items of interest, as we call it, in the show notes. And first up, oh, looks like it's me. Me. Might actually just hang up on all you guys and hijack the show. I'm back, baby. I'm back and I'm nationwide. So the Retro Computing Society of Rhode Island has, this is not news, by the way, but I only just found out about it. So it's news to me and I wanted to pass it on. First of all, I like the Retro Computing Society of Rhode Island. Fun to say. But they were donated a Cray, a J90. And of course, when I think Cray, I think the the round seats in the front, like the ones you want as a big piece of furniture. But of course, Cray is also synonymous with the big, big, big fast iron, the fastest things you can imagine. So they are restoring one and doing a nice set of a little bit of documenting of the process. I found it really interesting. So if you dig that kind of stuff, if the word Cray, in this case it's a J90, which is the Jedi series. How cool is that? So if the word Cray evokes super fast speed and just, you know, thinking I could never have a computer that fast, then you can read about them and lower your expectations. But also, if they're doing a really good job, I think, at the society of restoring it. In particular, there's one of the members of the Society of Rhode Island, a fellow named Michael Umbricht, is doing the restore. He's got a blog, and he's detailing it. And so he's many posts over the last year showing various stages, and people take photographs of it. I found it really interesting. And also, as a little bonus, on the Society's site, on the RCSRI's site itself, they have tons of great photos of unique vintage computer items. So just for the eye candy alone, it is worth dropping by this site. So I really liked it. The other thing I learned was the Cray J90, which came out like 94 or so, could have many processors. I think it supported up to like 32 processors at a clock speed of 100 megahertz. I was like, oh my goodness. So I used to have such a different opinion of the Cray. So when we all get old, I guess we all get slow. So that's my first bit of news there. RCRSI has got some wonderful eye candy to look at, and they're restoring a Cray and lowering my expectations. Now let's throw it over to Michael. Michael, what have you got for us?
Well, this one kind of leads in quite well from your host topic.
I'm very professional that way.
Yeah. The Retro Challenge for 2015 is underway. So previously known as the Winter Warm-Up, but is now just known as the 2015-01. I kind of liked Winter Warm-Up, seeing it had absolutely nothing to do with winter, at least down here. But if you're interested in a retro project, this might be a good way to have a bit of incentive to get going on it. Entries open, pop off an email to Mark at wickinsonline.co.uk and with a synopsis of your project and a URL of your blog, and then basically all of January, get in there, get some work done, blog it, get out into the world what you're up to. And it can be anything. It can be a little bit of software programming, a bit of hardware fiddling, some restoration work, anything that is loosely, nebulously connected to the retro computing world will get you in on the competition. So I'm going to resurrect the same thing as I tried to do on the last two retro challenges, and if I can't get it done this time, I've promised I will pick up a new topic to fail when we come to do the summer challenge in July.
Ooh, so last attempt.
Last attempt, yeah, to get my S-Basic processor to compile itself.
And what are the bookmaking odds on that one?
I wouldn't be putting money on it to succeed. So if you're backing for a fail, this could be a good one. No,
Excellent.
I really want to get into it this time, but it always seems that things seem to conspire against me at this time of year.
Oh. Is anybody else entering the Retro Challenge?
Well, I know that I was planning on it all the way up until the clock ticked over to January, but oh well.
What about you, Ken?
No, I'm not much of a programmer. I really haven't done any Apple II programs that I released since Spaceship of Death, which was a BBS door game.
You could restore a Cray.
I could. That's within my ken. Sure, why not? But no.
Or you could buy a Cray in a new in a box and open it as your project.
That would just be cray-cray.
Do an unboxing of a Cray. Brand new. That'd be fantastic. I like it. Paul,
Carrington.
I see, unfortunately, the letters and numbers C64.
Yes.
And yet, I'm going to throw it over to you anyway for you to talk about that most awful of platforms, the Commodore 64. What have you got for us?
Well, as it turns out, I just realized that this was also borrowed from listener feedback, so thanks, Tony, for sending this. This is another one of those things that got a fair amount of posting recently, but the Commodore 64 basic ROM was disassembled and commented. And I think this had not been done before, so this was posted on the site is pagetable.com, and there's a link in the show notes to it. What's I think sort of interesting about this is it's basically Microsoft Basic, and so what they did was this already existed for AppleSoft, the Microsoft Basic that ran on the Apple II, and so it turned out that pretty much you could just copy the comments over, you know. So it turned out not to be all, it turned out to be very little work, actually, as I understand it, to do the commenting of the C64 Basic ROM, because it was already done and everything matched up. So it's sort of an interesting kind of a testament to the fact that everybody was using the same Basic. So yeah, anyway, it's interesting. And if you were a C64 user and didn't care about the AppleSoft ROM having been commented, now you have your own in either English or German, I think.
I guess that's okay.
It relates to the Apple II enough, right?
Exactly. So I'll take it. I'll allow it. Speaking of things I'll allow, Ken.
You're allowing me?
I allow you.
You allow me to speak or you allow me to exist?
I just allow you. Take it as you will. I hope you appreciate it.
Such a blanket statement.
Give
I'm
us something uplifting.
This.
So I think Ken is going to now bring the party down.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you about how I spent my Christmas vacation.
Oh.
You know, not only is the Christmas season joyful with all the overcast skies and dark nights and long, long hours of no sunlight anywhere, but I spent my Christmas vacation writing obituaries. So much fun. So apparently there were at least 23 luminaries, and that they had many lumens among them, who passed away in 2014 and were contributors to the IT industry, either in its founding or in innovation. And Computer World assigned me to write obituaries for all of them. So I had to do some research into these 23 individuals whose names they had given me and find out that we lost last year the inventor of Kevlar, one of the three inventors of GPS, the creator of LCD, or liquid crystal displays, one of the six original theorists of the Higgs boson, also known as the God particle, the first African-American to get a PhD in computer science, and much, much more. I was able to add two names to that list. After I received the assignment, news broke that in late September we had lost Bob Bishop, former Kansas Fest keynote speaker and co-founder of Apple's R&D division along with Steve Wozniak. And then, as I was nearing the end of the assignment, Ralph Baer died, the creator of the video game system, the Magnavox Odyssey, which was the first home console to feature interchangeable cartridges. And so I wrote up about all these individuals. I shared the byline with my former coworker Rebecca Linke, who wrote about Professor Seth Teller at MIT, whom I was unable to because I work at MIT, and so there was a conflict of interest there. But the
And you're a suspect.
And the article got published at computerworld.com just before New Year's Eve and celebrates the lives of people whom may not have made as many headlines as Steve Jobs, but no less contributed to our community.
It's a bit of a downside of the hobby, I guess, is we're so many of the things that we talk about being a retro show is we're looking back, 30, 40 years, and a lot of people who are accomplishing these amazing things are, getting on in life. So it's unfortunately the case that this will probably be a regular occurrence in years to come, which is really too bad. But I think I was talking on Open Apple or something recently where one of the nice things I've noticed is, especially in the last year or so, there's so much documenting of things, so many interviews happening, and so many people, digging up old documents and making sure they get on archive.org. So it seems that more and more is getting saved. I guess more and more is also getting lost, but at least there does seem to be a collective attempt to store and retain the legacy of so many of these people. So at least that's nice. But yeah, so many of these names are names I was very familiar with. So it's really a sad bit of news.
But you know who's doing a great job of doing that sort of capturing and archiving that you describe is Antic, the Atari podcast. Kevin Savitz, Randy Kindig, and the mm-hmm. crew have been releasing interview-only episodes where they just sit down with somebody who played a role in the founding of this industry, whether they worked at Atari or BNC or some other company. In fact, Kevin even used LinkedIn to used me as an intermediary to connect with my friend Diane Gaw and did a whole episode with her because she worked at one of the magazines back in the day, and I've known her for years and was in the back of my mind aware of this connection, but since I'm an Apple guy, I never really thought to do anything with it. Fortunately, Kevin did and was able to get her on the line and record a great interview, and that's just one of a series that they're doing in addition to their usual podcast. So kudos to them for capturing that audio history.
I like that podcast a lot. Really, really like Hantik. It's one of the best ones out there. I also particularly like the stuff that Kevin's been doing with the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes.
And getting help. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. People, yeah, should definitely be subscribing to that show.
I took advantage of that, too. I sent a request to the FBI for a copy of my record, my whatever they have on me. And unfortunately, there was nothing.
You got envelope 1 of 6.
But no, like when the FBI doesn't have a record of you, I feel like I wasted my childhood.
No, you got away with it.
Ha ha.
And that's why you're putting up these lists now, Ken. Ken. Oh, Ken.
Well, I recall hearing as a rumor that if you ask the FBI for your own record and you have no record, they open a record on you. They assume you're up to something.
So you're saying I now need to send another request?
That's right.
If you ask for another request, then you're definitely getting a call. That's hilarious. So, Jack, what have you got for us news-wise for this first show of 2015?
Well, I've got some news that is about a name that is not quite dead, as some of Ken's names were we're talking about here, but it's about Atari. And people who are listening to this probably know that Atari has been kind of living a zombie-like existence for the past couple of decades, not releasing anything new hardware-wise or anything, having kind of fits and spurts of software in different categories. In the past year, they were bought by somebody else, this company. It's just kind of a brand at this point that changes hands and has some IP associated with it. And the latest sort of last-ditch effort they seem to be trying to do is they are trying to establish themselves as a kind of a fitness software company. And they've announced something called Atari Fit, a gamification fitness app to motivate players. So you have a bunch of exercise routines, and if you do well your exercises, you can unlock classic Atari games like Pong and Centipede and Super Breakout. So in case you have no... Since no one has any way to play these games in the world otherwise, you can play them within within Atari's Atari Fit app, apparently, if you do well your exercises. And they have online leaderboards and all sorts of stuff. Of course, it doesn't exist yet. This is vaporware at this point. They're saying this is coming in the beginning of 2015 for mobile devices, and it will integrate with Fitbit and Runkeeper. And their press release also includes, you know, like I said, a gamified. They like the word gamified. They're sort of like, it's kind of like they've got they're packing a lot of buzzwords into this. I'm not actually super impressed, you might hear, with the tone of my voice.
Well, I think what they should do is they should be using controls like the Wii has, motion tracking controls, so you could do like virtual dump dig, dig for cartridges, and then you find stuff and get to play it. That's what I would do.
Not a bad idea.
Just say it.
The virtual dump
dig. I agree with the, it's too bad that Atari isn't the Atari that I know. Like, I know it's a company that has the name Atari, and they still have the same, the Fuji logo, but the Atari that I loved in the past isn't really the company that exists now. So every time they come out with these things, I keep thinking they should have a different name almost.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. In a way, it's sort of cynical use of the Atari name and their old game catalog to sort of say, hey, we can make some new content kind of around these things. And I think that for modern humans, it's maybe not that interesting to sort of be able to say, wow, if I do really well at my run, I can play Pong on my phone. Because chances are there's a way to play Pong on your phone anyway.
Almost certainly, yes. But still, it is neat that, I mean, it still sticks around. They're releasing more stuff than Amiga is, so.
That's certainly true. And I think that despite my cynicism, I think part of my cynicism is the fact that I am not a healthy person who uses things like a Fitbit or what have you. So,
but now will you?
No.
You can play Pong. There's
well,
Pong.
Hey, now that you mention it, I didn't think of it.
There's no other way to play Pong.
No, there is no other way. You're right.
At least if you're not on that German street.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Other than there, you can't play it. Well done. Well played. Michael, let's head to the other side of the planet and talk to you if the snakes and spiders and stuff have not killed you mid-show. What have you got to talk to us about the Imitation Game, which recently I saw, and it's awesome.
Okay. Well, it's more because the Imitation Game is released and out there. I thought I would just bring back a link that I quite like, which is a photo tour of Bletchley Park. So, again, it's more eye candy. So if you want to have a little bit of a wander around Bletchley Park, the exhibits and everything that are there, this is quite a nice little photo tour put up by CNET. So if you want to pop through, look at the actual Enigma machines, the buildings around the actual park and the exhibits, this is a good place to pop in if you can't actually get over and do the tour yourself. And yes, I'm really looking forward to watching the movie and see if I can pick up some of the historical inaccuracies as well.
I really enjoyed it, though.
Have we already reviewed that movie on this show?
I don't believe we have.
Ah, well, at least Carrington and I have seen it. Anybody else?
I have not. I intend to.
Let's spoil it.
It was good. I mean, there are other adaptations of this story. There is a stage play. I think there's a movie called Codebreaker. If you go to Wikipedia, they'll list the many historical inaccuracies, or rather creative licenses that they took with the adaptation, the worst of which I thought was the portrayal of Alan Turing as somebody who essentially has Asperger's syndrome, more like Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes, really, who just can't get along with anybody, and he wasn't anywhere near quite that bad from what I understand. But other than that, I thought it was a good movie. I liked it. I understand that they needed a villain character, and so they sort of turned one of the military characters into more of a jerk than he actually was, which his grandkids aren't quite happy about. But yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a good movie. I'm glad I saw it.
I liked it a lot.
Excellent. Okay.
And those five words, you said everything I said. Thank you.
Well, so based on Carrington's in-depth analysis, rather than Ken just glibly glossing over it, I think I'll go see the movie.
I went in with actually very low expectations because I thought this is going to be terrible and they're going to rip it up and it's going to be all Keira Knightley all the time. And I went in thinking it'll just be awful, and I ended up really enjoying it. I was like, oh, this is actually fun, and funnier than I thought it would be, and I didn't really care about how historically accurate it was. It's just like, you know, it's based on this guy, and I'm like, bring it. Let's have some. And I thought it was well made, and I actually had a really good time watching it. So I think people who are interested in the topic, as long as you're not too sniffy about the accuracy, but it's historical, whatever. Nobody was there. Well, I guess some people were there, but then we killed them all. So I think I enjoyed seeing it, and it was based on a time and a topic I find interesting, and a guy who I think was pretty darn awesome. And it's a, you know, it's a weird take on Turing, but hey, it's a movie about Turing, so I'll take it. I'll take a new one every week if they'll make it.
Now, I'm very interested in later this month when I go back into the classroom. I teach at the college level, and I always spend the first night of class going over the history of computers and the internet. And every semester I've been teaching this class over the last 3 years, nobody has ever heard of Alan Turing before. So I have to go in depth about, you know, the Turing machine, the Turing test. I'm wondering if that will be different this semester, if I'll have students who say, oh yeah, I saw that movie. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, he's Keira Knightley's boyfriend.
Oh, you treated him badly.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I have found that college students absolutely love Benedict Cumberbatch. So I'm curious to see if that translates into a reason for them to go see this movie. But I am wondering, is it a good thing or a bad thing to introduce people to a concept or an aspect of history they may not have been aware of if you are doing so with inaccuracies? Is it better for them to at least have an awareness of who Alan Turing was, even if there are some misconceptions involved, or is it better for them to have never have heard of him?
I think it's better to be aware of him. We don't, there's no such thing as real documentaries anyway.
Yeah, I think that it's better that there's a whole new audience being aware of him, and then if that kind of topic interests them, then they've got plenty of tools available to go and see what was not properly portrayed in the movie. And there's enough talk in the movie reviews about some of these inaccuracies and the way they've portrayed it, and just some of the story license that they've taken. So there's enough interest there. They'll go and look for the backstory. But definitely someone who should be more aware in the technical consciousness.
I would sort of imagine too that, at least I'm guessing that, not all that many people come away from something that is sort of dramatic like this and think that must have been absolutely true. You know, I mean, I certainly don't expect everything to be accurate in many of these types of things. Although I still look for the inaccuracies, but, you know, definitely I would agree that it's better that people at least have some way in to this topic.
I think it's more likely that people go to the movies and not realize that what they saw was real at all. For example, the film Unbroken, there were times when I heard the person talking behind me about the film, and I could tell that she thought this was just another fictionalized World War II movie. I hope that she stuck around for the epilogue, which made clear that this is true, and The Imitation Game has a similar epilogue that outlines what happened after the film ended. But, yeah, I think most people just go to the movies because they want to turn their brains off and not think about it, and heaven forbid they learn something.
As I recall, the TV series adaptation of Fargo started off with a thing that said the events are true, which of course is completely false. But
I think
the
movie started with that as well.
Really?
The movie had like a text screen in the beginning that says this is a true story or something like that. And they had to kind of back and say, well, it's not true in the technical sense of
it's
being
truly
true.
A story.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember the movie or the show that started off, this is a true story, only the facts have been changed to protect the guilty.
Yes.
Facts.
Well, I mean, even the movie Defending Your Life, which is about the whole
I
film.
I love that movie.
So do
nobody
I.
Nobody knows that. No, Ken, that's why you're awesome.
Albert Brooks, Meryl Streep, how can you go wrong?
That well, actually, at the time, I was never a fan of either of them. I saw it in spite of them being in it, and it made me a fan of both, and I adore that movie.
But it starts off with, this is based on a true story. And the whole film is set in the afterlife.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's true that somebody once died. But I don't think you can realistically conjecture what happened to them after that.
Well, they then had a court case, and they, you know, had to defend their life and used more of their brain, and I like that movie a lot. It's a good movie.
The more of your brain you use, the better food tastes. It makes perfect sense.
Of course it does.
Anyway, this will taste like crap to you because you're stupid.
You're one of the little brains. Anyway, good film. People should watch that film.
Carry on.
In fact, we shall carry on. Let's throw it to Paul. Paul, it looks like you've got a YouTube link to us. Convince me. Convince me why I and all of our listeners should click on that link in our show notes.
Yes, exactly. Well, speaking of movies, this is the EEV blog. What's the guy's name again? Dave Jones did recently Tear Down of Elisa 2. So he sort of periodically takes things. You know, we've mentioned his blog before, but so he took Elisa 2 and kind of went through it, you know, taking it apart and looking at the things in it. It's kind of interesting to see, you know, some inaccuracies here and there, but it's neat to see if you haven't seen this, but it's also a very good sort of example of what can go wrong if you don't take those batteries out. so the one he was taking apart had a he didn't have a mouse or a keyboard for it, so already we were fairly far from having it be able to work. But the battery backup on the I think it's the I/O board leaked, as they do. So if you have a Lisa that might have batteries on them on it, take out the batteries. They will destroy it. Still, apart from the corrosion, he gave sort of a nice video of the disassembly, and the Lisa is actually really cool in how nicely it is designed to take apart. You know, everything sort of slides in and out. You just turn little screws. There's no screwdriver required. Anyway, it's neat. It's worth watching.
You have convinced me. I shall click on the link.
Meet you back here.
Well done, you. And let's wrap it up with Ken. Ken, looks like you've got a couple of things for us. I'm going to hog all the last news. Give us a twofer from Ken. What have you got?
You mean about somebody who didn't die?
Yes, bring us up.
Well, there have been a couple of games that have released recently. I love new games for old machines. The first is Did It Come From the Desert, which is based on a TurboGrafx-16 game called It Came From the Desert. It is a first-person shooter, and it just came out for the Commodore Amiga, which is pretty impressive. There actually is a really cool documentary that I just recently found on YouTube. I don't have the name of it in front of me, but it's basically like the history of first-person shooters, like Doom and Quake, and how it led to the death of the old school machines that were not capable of running this new genre of gaming that was so popular. I'll send you a link for that to include in the show notes. But that doesn't mean that old school systems aren't capable of first-person shooters or first-person perspective games. For example, the 2GS has Wolf 3D and the 8-bit Apple II has Escape from the Homebrew Computer Club by David Schmenk. So I love seeing these new games come out for old machines. The other game that I want to talk about is Retro Shadowgate, which just came out from a company called Zojoy. And this is basically the Apple IIgs and Macintosh version of Shadowgate, as well as its colleagues Uninvited, Deja Vu, and Deja Vu 2, except these games will run on Mac and Linux. Now, if you're playing these games and they don't look exactly like you remember, there's a reason for that. I got an email from Dave Marsh, one of the original co-creators of Shadowgate, and he says that Retro Shadowgate uses the original assets, but the user interface is coded from scratch to resemble the 2GS and Mac, but it's not exact. It uses your operating system's default sans serif font instead of the original font, which was called Chicago and is copyrighted by Apple. So there are some slight differences here, but if you want to play the original Shadowgate in a modern environment without having to boot up an emulator and get a disk image, you can do that by buying these games right from Zojoy.com, which is Zojoy.com. This is separate from the new Shadowgate game that came out in August, which I helped back on Kickstarter 2.5 years ago. That game was on the cover of JuiceGS, and unfortunately, and not very wisely, we did not actually include a photo of the new Shadowgate in JuiceGS. We just spent 5 pages talking about it without actually showing the readers what the game looks like. But I've been playing that on my Mac. I have some YouTube videos of it, and I'm actually a big fan of it. I think that the update that they released around Halloween did a lot to fix the UI and bring it up to modern standards, and it's just a lot of fun to play, and especially since they changed some of the puzzles just enough that you think, oh, I remember this from when I played it 25 years ago, but now it's different. How do I solve it now? It's a great mixture of new and old. So yeah, Shadowgate.
Very nice. I'm most excited to actually play Uninvited. That's a game I quite liked, and so I'm thrilled to see that exists from them as well. So definitely something I'm going to go and take a stab at. That's awesome.
Well, the new Shadowgate that they just came out with last year, they designed a whole new game system so that they could adapt not just Shadowgate, but if that game was successful, then go on and do the Uninvited and Deja Vu and Deja Vu 2. We talked about that in JuiceGS, and it sounds like that is their plan, so there will be more reimaginings of these classic point-and-click MacVenture games.
Nice. Excellent. That's really exciting.
Isn't it?
I like it. Well done, you.
Aw, thanks. I win.
Okay, now it is time for us to do some shopping. Now, first, of course, the vintage computer commercial. The commercial is not so much a commercial as a little bit of a time capsule from 1994 about getting your dad online with the help of Wired magazine and a bunch of total hipsters who use words like the Infobon. And if you forgot about terms like Infobon, you get to hear them all in like a two-minute thing. It's quite delightful.
Okay, forget the fun and games. It's time to get serious. And for dads to be truly inspired, they need to be truly wired. And speaking of wired...
Hi, I'm Will Kreth of Wired Magazine, the publication that's leading the coverage of the digital revolution. And these are the offices of Wired Magazine. And getting wired means getting an electronic address for your computer.
With an email address, you can tap into 20 million other computers on a worldwide system called the Internet. You can send and receive mail to and from people all over the world. Dad can log on 24 hours a day and find out what the email mailman has dropped off. Just read my email. Also, Dad can communicate with people live anywhere in the world by typing on the keyboard. You can join a live discussion group and exchange information about a favorite hobby, or ask the locals in Europe for travel tips, or just stay in touch with friends.
For example, I just found out about a World War II bomber pilot who lives alone and likes to swap war stories with other veterans over his online service. As a Father's Day gift, you might offer a startup subscription to one of the online services.
To get started, you can subscribe to a simple Get Me Online service like Delphi for $12 a month, or to Netcom for $17.50 a month.
To get connected, you need a computer and a modem.
A modem typically costs from $50 to $300, and many now come with a free introductory subscription to one of the online services. Or for less than $10 a month plus usage fees, you can subscribe to a special service such as America Online, Genie, Prodigy, or CompuServe. Each service has its own easy-to-use graphical interface and offers special features such as news, stock prices, business services, and sports results.
Remember, each service will charge a monthly fee and an hourly connection cost.
But once Pop gets off his analog couch and gets his license to cruise the Infobahn, he just might become a digital dad.
So that's what I selected for our vintage commercial. Now, what I've selected for the host's retro computing gift idea, which is, of course, something you all can buy from me, is a floppy disk pillow. It's available on Etsy, and it's a bit pricey. But it's so adorable, I couldn't resist. Now, the floppy pillow is this little handmade throw pillow for, I think it's $40. So it's a little expensive, but it is adorable. And what I like about the floppy disk pillow is it is a proper, what I consider a proper floppy disk. It is the 5 1/4, not the 3.5-inch newfangled one. Who wants those? So it's, I think, roughly in inches, 13 inches square, but it looks just like a felt, squishy floppy disk pillow, and that is what I'm suggesting you all buy me for Christmas for $45.
Cool.
Fantastic.
I think you need to update the show notes because there's a link to a tie cuff link or something.
Already done.
Yep. Oh.
But
well then.
I'm speedy. So, and now that Ken really wants the link to work because he's going to go off and buy it for me is, well, I
no,
think, the takeaway we have.
The reason I was wondering is because I have a floppy pillow that was made for me 4 years ago. And as far as I know, it's a one of a kind. And I want to know if somebody is now making this mass production style.
Or if somebody has stolen your floppy pillow.
No, actually, this looks quite different.
Yeah, I wonder what form of disk protection it's using.
Well, if you pierce the side of it to put things on the back, you'll just get stuffing everywhere, so that's part of the protection. So it's not double-sided, alas.
No half-tracking?
Let's do a little bit more shopping, and let's head over to eBay, etc., and see who's got what for things that other people can buy. Let's say me. Yes, buy me things on eBay. Now, what I'm selecting, it looks like, once again, I get to go first, is I am going to pick a thing that I think fits in really well with what Ken was saying earlier, games that you could play and do Let's Play videos of. And it's a game that I adore for the Apple II, and it's one that doesn't come up boxed that often on eBay. And the reality is, if you're not going to get a fully boxed system, a game on eBay, why even bother buying it? Because if you just want to play the game, they're available in disk images for emulators. And I'm selecting Captain Goodnight and the Islands of Fear. It is one of, I consider, the best arcade-type games for the Apple II. I adore it. Super fun to play. Great action. Lots of comedy. And this is a nice, what looks like relatively complete, relatively intact box copy. No bids yet. $55. I anticipate it will sell, and it will sell for a lot more than $55 because it's a popular game. Doesn't come up in nice, good, complete copies on eBay often. So I suspect the bidding will be fast and furious on it. So that is what I am selecting. Captain Goodnight and the Islands of Fear for the Apple II. Michael, what have you got? Or was somebody going to comment on mine?
I was just going to quickly say that I agree. It's very. I'm not sure that I actually made it to the end of it, but it's graphically, it's a very impressive game. And the other thing is it has a decoder. So one nice thing about getting it in the box is that you have. And I think in this version it's in the manual and not an actual ring decoder, but it's protected by the documentation. So. If at some point you get to you know, later in the game and it asks you for this, it's nice to have the box.
And it's a nice looking box.
Yep.
I like it. I love this game.
Actually, one of the things that I remember from right at the beginning of playing this game is that you, if you sit there and try to figure out what to do and you just kind of like don't do anything, eventually the little guy you control will just like start playing with his yo-yo.
As we all do. So, Michael, what have you got for us?
Well, This one sort of hit me as a bit of a surprise as I was looking for something related, and it's the Rocky Horror Show The Game for your Commodore 64. So, Carrington, you can just pop off and make a cup of tea and come back in a little bit. But, I wasn't aware of this game being out for any platform. But, it's I suppose once you get past the title screen, you're getting into less and less Rocky Horror Picture Show, but you play as either Brad or Janet. You have to go around the castle finding all the bits and pieces to build the D-Medusa to rescue your partner from being the evil clutches and make it out alive. But it's got all the characters loose, as I said, it's loosely based on the show, or at least based on the names of the characters of the show. And you can try and pick it up. Opening bid, I believe, of $9.95. And that's in Australian dollars, so that's considerably less for everyone over in the US.
It's actually a game that did exist for a bunch of platforms. I played it on the Apple II. It is a game that did exist for my preferred platform. And I think there was also a ZX Spectrum version.
Okay.
And maybe
I just wasn't aware of it. Now, as most people are, that you're aware of the movie, you've been down in the front in costume, going along with the lines of the show. So.
Cool.
And a great time of year to pick it. Here in Toronto, there's always a midnight showing for New Year's of the Rocky Horror at one of the cinemas locally here. And so, Paul, what have you got for us? Will there be one, two, three, maybe five different choices?
Yes, Paul's back on form.
Yes. I have a couple just little goofy ones that I wanted to or at least one. Listed. I've seen this listed before, actually. I hope I didn't actually put it in show notes previously, but it's a 1960s vintage IBM ThinkPad. And what it is it's a notepad that has Think on one side and IBM on the other. It is, in fact, from the 1960s, but I like that it is a ThinkPad. One of the things that was sort of most interesting that I came across was somebody is selling an Olivetti P602. I know, again, I'm back in this area that I don't know anything about, but I didn't really know anything about this. I dug around a little bit, but the Olivetti P602 is an early microcomputer. So you can find ads online that talk about how it's, from the company that invented the microcomputer. In 1971, they introduced this thing. And it's really kind of cool looking. It's, so it actually looks a little bit like a cash register. It's huge and heavy. But it reads, it has a little magnetic card reader, and it can do computations, I don't know exactly what you can do with it. And the listing itself says, when going through my grandpa's attic, I stumbled upon this vintage computer. I don't know how it works, So, nevertheless, he's starting at, it's a buy it now of 500, which might be reasonable. I don't really know, to what degree these are rare, but I suspect they are.
Well, I like that it comes with a bunch of program cards.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the built-in printer works, because if so, then this would be a super fun thing to at least play with for a bit.
It looks quite clean, too. So, that's, when I was digging around to find something out about this thing, I did find some photos of other, other people who had them and took them apart and, sort of took photos of them and, in much worse shape than this. So, at least, even if nothing works, it looks nice.
I like it. Yeah. I like it. Nice. Well done, you. Do you want to throw in some of the others? I see you've got a big collection here.
I think I can leave it at that.
Okay, well, nice choices then, as they are. Ken, how about you? What have you got for us?
I also have a game, because that's how I roll. I'm a gamer. And I found a copy of... Actually, are we allowed to talk about auctions that have already ended?
Sure. Hit me.
Oh, good. Well, this is Wizardry, Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord. And it's sort of an odd auction, because first of all, they get the title wrong. It says, Wizardry, Proving Grounds of the Mad King. I've never played that game, and nor is it what they picture in the...
You like it when you get the names wrong, though, because it's likely that people searching for it might not find it, and you can pick it up for a song.
True, but I still have to wonder if this person can't even read the name off the box that they took a photograph of to put in the auction, then how likely is it that they took care of the product?
If they Overlord's have... a big word, though.
I know,
so much
three
typing.
Whole syllables, honestly.
It looks like they cut and pasted it correctly down in the listing, though.
Yes, that's true. I think maybe they were just copying somebody else. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but the title of the auction and the photos, but not the description, indicates that there is another game in this same lot, and it's called Thunder Chopper. Now, the description, like I said, doesn't say anything about this game. I don't know if they just forgot to describe it, but I had never heard of Thunder Chopper, and I was wondering, are they talking about Choplifter, or, I don't know, Thunder in Paradise, starring Hulk Hogan? I don't know. but apparently there was a game called Thunder Chopper, released in 1987 by ActionSoft Corporation, and it has something to do with helicopters, as the name might imply, and I don't know anything about it, so I think it's interesting when there is an Apple II game that I've never heard of.
I've never heard of it either. Moby Games has a listing, but I've never heard of this.
Going into the listing and looking at the photo of the manual and the sticker on the disc, I thought I was reasonably familiar with all of the chopper-type plane flight simulator games, so it's one I'm not aware of.
The reviews seem to be mostly in German, so maybe it was something that was released only overseas.
Well, the label on the disc is in English. Mm. It says, for the Apple II computer, copyright 1987. I do a YouTube search on Thunder Chopper, and there...
It's fun to say.
Exactly. It sounds like some sort of a kitchen utensil. The Thunder Chopper. Anyway, so there are no Let's Play videos of this game. And there was a YouTube user, I think his name was High Lord Retro Gamer or something of the sort, and he basically...
Oh, bow down. Check out this guy.
He basically played through every single Apple II game in alphabetical order.
Nice.
And I would think that if Thunder Chopper was a thing, then I would find a video by him. But there, if you do a search for Thunder Chopper Apple, you get all these hits for Apple Thunderbolt, which is not the same thing.
So did that guy miss this game? Does he have to go back and play all the games again?
Yes, he has to start from scratch. That's right.
Nice. Comes with this card that shows like the joystick motions and also like every key is mapped to something. It looks like quite a complicated game.
I know. It's like the Steel Battalion of the Apple II.
Nice.
High Retro Game Lord 89, that was his YouTube name, and he has since moved on from the Apple II to other platforms, but apparently this game was not one of the ones he played through five years ago.
This would have been an auction worth picking up just for that game. Forget the... Everybody's got a copy of the Mad King.
Exactly, you know? Anyway.
Nice. Good choice.
Thanks.
It was a little pricey, but...
Yeah, but Ken can afford it.
Yeah.
He's rolling in it.
My YouTube revenue...
Yeah, exactly, you'll rebox it.
I play games, I make money off the games, I use the money to buy games that I play.
It's the circle of life with Ken.
So this auction apparently did not successfully conclude. It was a starting bid of $50, and it says zero bid, so I think that means it didn't end, but it also says a price of $125.
Nobody participated.
Nobody bid. Okay.
Yeah. So what is the $125 price?
Was probably the buy it now price.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
So when he relisted as Wizardry Proving Grounds of the Lion King, maybe it'll do better. We'll just keep changing it. Circle
Why not?
Left again.
Sure.
I think there should be your image should be you up on a cliff holding up like the Lion King. You're going to hold out a game, and that's the game that you do your Let's Play on.
Yeah, well, I found a Commodore 64 version of it over on Retro Game Shop.
Ah, nice.
But no, it's still not turning on any light bulbs for me.
Nope.
It may have made its way here from a different dimension.
Cool.
Definitely
worth it, nothing.
Yeah.
So, Jack, you've got to follow that. Like, I hope you've got something pretty awesome to round out the show. What have you selected for our eBay pick?
I've got something that I think is pretty awesome that I remember being excited about back in the day, 30-ish years ago, but never actually saw or held in my hands or used. So after Nolan Bushnell sold and then left Atari, he started a company called Axlon, which went into robotics. And they actually produced some robot toys that did some things, but this first thing that they announced was this thing called the Andy. And the Andy product, as far as I know, I don't think this ever actually became a real product that they sold. The idea was this was a robot you would plug into either your Atari 8-bit or your Commodore 64 through the joystick port, and you could either directly make this thing drive around on your desk or your floor at a pretty long cable, I think, or you could write software that would in some way interact with this thing. It had some sensors, it had some light sensors and touch sensors, so
You could, the idea was you could program this thing to navigate a maze or something. It didn't have any sort of like arms to like hold anything. You could no sort of robot claw to grab anything. But it was a thing that you could sort of drive it around in some ways with some software. And again, I think this was sort of a prototype really for further developments they had later on. And I found an interview from Antic Magazine in about 1985 where they were going to sell this thing, they said, for $120 at that time. Figured it would drop down to $70 in the coming years. Right now, you can buy one of these on eBay for a whopping $400. That's the ask now price. But there are actually no bids right now. So if you want to go for something less than that, I guess you can give it a shot. It doesn't say, well, it doesn't really guarantee that this thing works or anything like that. It says it looks like it's in good shape. I searched around and I found a couple of YouTube videos of people who were playing with with these devices. And there was someone who showed that the motor still worked. He sort of turned his robot on its side and ran the wheels. Didn't actually show it driving around at all. I found another video that seemed, as I sort of scrubbed through it, it looked like it was actually moving around, but I realized that they were in fact just pulling the cable. So it wasn't really... It's kind of disheartening, really, but who knows, it might work. And if you have $400 burning a hole in your pocket and want to have a possibly broken robot that doesn't work with any modern systems, this is your thing.
I like it. I love 80s robots.
Yep.
80s robots were the best.
I think
robots.
I'm more interested in it now than I would have been back then, because if that's all it does, I think I would have been totally underwhelmed, even for 1985. But as a piece of retro art, I don't think I'd be buying it for $400, but... yeah.
But I'm almost tempted. It's pretty awesome.
It really does look very cool. It looks sort of like... Well, the head looks... basically like the Topo, which is, you know, a much more famous robot.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing looks like a shoe. It's really it's a very, very interesting looking thing.
I dig it. I dig it a lot. Nice, nice find. Well done.
And actually, when you said that this was Axlon, I'm going to retract my stopping on the eBay auctions, because one of the things I picked... was also an Axlon thing. So I thought it was just sort of interesting that I had never heard of this company, and now two of them showed up. So the other auction that will now make it into the show notes, I guess, is just for a little data terminal that was it's basically a calculator-sized thing, but it's specifically to act as a terminal. It has an acoustic coupler, and you can dial in over the phone if you want that for $100.
Oh, and it's got one of those acoustic couplers that's just the two pads, and you strap them to the phone.
Yeah.
I like those.
Yeah, I saw that in your listing earlier. I wonder, do you think that's the same Axlon? I honestly don't know.
Good question. I don't know. Sunnyvale, California, 1982. It sounds plausible.
I bet that is. Yep.
We got to get this thing and that robot together and see what happens.
Right.
And you're the man with the Atari 800 to do it.
I am the man with the Atari 800. I like my Atari 800.
Poking around here, I can actually see a similar-looking icon on the manual that comes with the robot and some piece of paper that comes with the Axlon data link thing there. So it's, I guess it's the same.
Cool.
Cool. Very cool. Nice. I like it. Good choices, everybody. Well done. Good start to the new year. But it looks like that's actually coming to the end of the show. Now, looking through our closing discussions, anything to add, etc., nobody seems to have anything. Is that correct? Running around the table, does nobody have anything going on at all?
I can make up something.
Ken, save us. Make something up.
Well, this is an exercise I recently undertook, and Carrington, you saw evidence of it on Twitter, which was one of my New Year's resolutions. I spent the first 2 days of 2015 clearing out my email inbox. I got down to inbox zero, which has not happened in more than 5 years, because I had emails all the way back from 2010. In my inbox. And I didn't just shove them into a folder or just nuke my inbox and start from scratch. I actually went through and I replied to these emails, and it was so much fun. There was an email from 2010. I clicked reply and just wrote back as if nothing had happened, and the person wrote back to me like nothing had happened, just picked up the thread. Another person said, okay, I had to read the original email to remember what we were talking about, but now I'm down with it, and we exchanged a flurry of emails on that same topic. The Apple II connection comes in multiple ways, because most of these people I was emailing were Apple II people. There was one person, Brian Weiser, who I replied to an email from 4 years ago. And I said, hey, remember those photos that you sent me for use in JuiceGS and how we used only one of them? Can we put the rest on our website? And he wrote back right away and said, sure. So now we have a new photo gallery on our website. There was another person named Joe Walters who I was talking to about whether or not JuiceGS should remain hard copy only or be a PDF. And then sometime last year, there was an email sent to the KFest list that said Joe Walters had died. And I felt awful. I'm like, oh no, I never replied to his email. He died waiting to hear from me. But then it turned out that there were two Joe Walters in the Apple II community. And the one I was emailing with was still alive. Which I only found out when I emailed him last summer and I said, hey, sorry to be macabre, but are you alive? And he wrote back and said, why, yes, I am.
You talk about death a lot on this show.
I do.
He was just hanging on, waiting for your reply.
But I'm really glad.
Now he's got it, he's dead.
But I'm really glad this Joe Walters is alive because he's a JuiceGS subscriber and I'd hate to lose that revenue.
Yeah.
You know, so I started emailing with him again, and there was another email from Peter Watson, who is the developer of Mug, which was some MS-DOS utilities in, I think, NDA format for the Apple IIgs. So yeah, I just had a lot of fun going through these old emails and getting back to everybody, and I really am tickled that nobody seemed to mind.
People would be surprised if I wrote them. I'm terrible for writing back. Emails more for me is more like jazz. It's about the letters you don't send, you know?
I think I did that something sort of similar. Just it was probably a couple of years ago now, but my email stretches back to I think it's like 1992 or something like that. And about that point, I'm pretty sure it was 92, had recommended some band or something that, you know, I was supposed to listen to, and I finally did listen to it in something like 2012, and then replied. And it's very pleasing to do that. Usually the email addresses don't work when you get back that far.
Yes, that is true when it's like at TimeNet or BitNet.
Right.
It's just a CompuServe number.
Oh gosh, I still remember mine.
Really? That's crazy.
75162.3001.
You're going to get spammed now.
Actually, I was waiting for you to say, I am Jean Valjean.
I am not a number.
Well, anybody else? Anymore?
Yeah, well, on the email theme, people should just be glad that their emails to me are in the inbox, because that means I didn't delete them. I just use search. But the only thing that I hope to be happening is doing the retro challenge, but
third time's the charm.
Yeah, talk to me in 3 shows' time, and we'll see how successful I wasn't.
That's the spirit. That's the enthusiasm we're looking for.
Yeah, and I think we sort of covered actually the closing discussions in our host topic, I think, in a way. So maybe that's why everybody's
how
kind
I roll. You just scroll around and just make an infinite show. But what about you, Jack? Anything to wrap up the show with?
Not too much here. I'm actually kind of I was thinking about doing the retro challenge, and like Paul said, when it rolled around and had started, I realized, oh, I haven't done that. And in a way, actually, the other point about email is kind of a different sort of retro challenge, the challenge to sort of deal with a retro pile of stuff, which is your old email. And I guess my thoughts on that are similar to what Michael said. I kind of use search, and I kind of gave up on inbox and any meaningful number. I'm approaching inbox infinity, essentially. This is the point that usually I often quit my mail app just to not shock people, so they don't see that number in the little badge showing how many thousands of just unread email I have.
I practice Outbox Zero.
Yeah, Outbox Zero. There we go. Now, so I think that maybe my I should probably try and deal with my email in a similar way. Like you were saying, Ken, I don't think I'm going to go back and answer old email, but I should at least, I don't know, mark it as read.
Yes, I tried it. You know, just last year I started using the flag function in Apple Mail so that I can put something into a folder so it's out of mine, but I still have a little flag remind me I do need to reply to it. Just because it's not in my inbox doesn't mean I can ignore it. So I worked through my inbox. That was my first goal. I still have lots of flagged emails, maybe about 50 or so, but still, my inbox for a brief time was at 0. Now it's at 12, but you know, these things happen. It's Sisyphean.
Yeah. Never
ends. Okay, so that's how you do it. If you select all, flag, move.
Well, no, that's not what I did. I didn't flag any of the messages that were in my inbox last week. I actually either replied to them, filed them, or deleted them. That was separate from my flag folder, which only goes back 2 years.
Excellent. Yeah, methinks he doth protest too much.
Oh, hush you. You're lucky you even have email.
Well, we've just introduced it down here in Australia. Up until then, no. Nah.
And aren't you paying like 10 cents per message or something?
You gotta use actual stamps. But you gotta take a photo of the stamp and attach it as an attachment to the email for it to go through. That's how it works up here in Canada.
Yeah.
Well, I think that wraps up the show, now that we're bashing each other's countries.
Oh,
we've come to that time where we wrap things up so the gloves don't come off. Thank you to everybody for tuning in to listening. It's great to be back. I was away from the show for like a month and a half there, 2 months, so delighted to be back, and thanks for letting me host. For you listeners, old and new, we talked about tons of interesting stuff, and you can find out all the links. Find the links. Remind yourself of the good old times during this show. Oh, remember about half an hour ago? Wasn't that awesome? And you can find all that at our show notes, at our blog, our website. That's what they're called. Oh, the Infobon. You can find us at rcrpodcast.com. We got a forum. You'll find a link on there to go over to the forum. You can follow us on Twitter, which is just at rcrpodcast, which is a great way to send us links and ideas or feedback on the show. Speaking of feedback, you can write to us, feedback at rcrpodcast.com. Best way, though, to give feedback is 5 stars, baby. Head over to iTunes. Give us a review. Give us the love. You know you want to. Meanwhile, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the first show of 2015, which is a lovely number in binary. What is it? 11111101111.
Which is a palindrome. It's a palindrome.
I know. I think the most interesting binary number we're going to have until, till 2047. So, pretty nice one. Meanwhile, thanks for listening, and
Retro Compute!
Please let it be over.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Do we stop recording?
Yep.
Okay.
And then we swear like sailors.